Thanks, Belinda. Thanks very much. Good afternoon. The world is awash with data, as you've probably noticed. And in fact, every year the IT industry gets a couple of buzzwords and hammers them into clients. And that's part of their global strategy, to just kind of say, this is the message and this is why you should spend 5 or 10% of your entire revenue with this year. And big data is one of the buzzwords for this year. So if you haven't heard a lot of it yet, you will over the next few months. What does it mean? The answer really is nothing. It's a marketing buzz phrase. We've always had data, ever since we invented computers, the telegraph, ever since we invented writing on paper. We've recorded more data than we recorded the year before, and we've continually worked out new ways of doing things with it. But if you do hear the word big data, be aware that someone is probably trying to sell you something, and what I'm trying to sell you today by using it is the idea that we are going through a change in the way we use data that is absolutely comprehensive, and it's happening right across society. Data, information is power, so I think when you look around the world, you'll see that we're changing the way the world deals with information in every part of our lives. And that means we're changing the way we deal with power. So what I want to do today is kind of cruise through some of the observations that I've made in recent months about what's happening in this area. In your course, I know you're looking at some of the historical background and looking at some of the more theoretical stuff. What I'm going to do today is show you really what's happening now and what might unfold in the next few years as just a thing to think about. Now, I'm pretty informal about this, so if you have any questions, do feel free to ask. Also, you may not be able to see it, but I'm recording this session. I tend to put all of my presentations on my website within a few days of them happening. If you do ask a question and you do not want your voice to appear in the final recording for some reason, the safe word is penguin. To our topic, I'm really going to look at where this data is coming from, who's collecting it, what it reveals when you analyse it, and what some of the state of the art is in that, and as I say, a sneak peek into the future. Now, we've got that word algorithm in the lecture title. An algorithm is just a recipe for a computer to follow. You'll find some more formal definitions if you look it up. But essentially, it's just a recipe. If you can specify the recipe, then someone can write a computer program to implement it. Don't be baffled by the word. Now, the place to begin with all this is that everything you do on the internet is tracked by someone, and effectively that tracking and the record of that tracking is kept forever by someone, and there's not a whole lot you can do about that, because the fundamental problem is if you are connecting to the internet to request information, the other end of that connection needs to know where to deliver it, and the other end of the connection can record whatever data they like about that. So, obvious examples. Every search you type into Google is recorded by Google and kept by them pretty much forever. Every link you click on as a result of that search is kept by Google as well. So you might even notice that sometimes if you're logged in, you'll see a link and it'll actually tell you you last visited that site in September 2006 or something like that. It has kept all of that forever. Same goes for Facebook, same goes for Twitter, same goes for Yahoo, same goes for the ABC, same goes for the Sydney Morning Herald and so on. How that happens, and this may be familiar for some of you, but we'll soon get into that. Here's a typical news website. It's the West Australian from Perth from a few months ago. No need to update the graphic because the key point I'm making is highlighted with the red arrow. This website belongs to the Yahoo Empire. That means that as you move through this website, you are tracked by at least these five organisations. Six if you count Yahoo's different branches as a separate arm. Yahoo itself, because they own the website, they know which pages you looked at and how long, as does DoubleClick, which is part of the Google empire. That is an advertising network. So if you wish to buy banner ads on websites, DoubleClick is one of the organizations you might choose to do that through. You would ask them to show this banner ad for a new BMW to males over the age of 45 with an income above $70,000 a year, or whatever it might be. Nielsen, you've probably heard of for their TV and radio ratings. They do website ratings as well, so they're aggregating audience figures. And Right Media and iBlaster are also advertising networks. This is a relatively small number of such third parties who might be tracking you when you visit a website. It's not uncommon for there to be 11 or 12 third parties involved. The interesting thing about all this is that while you might then visit the West Australian's website, you might then go on to any number of other websites, but if DoubleClick is in there and they're one of the market leaders, they can track your movements across multiple websites. So whereas an individual website only knows about your browsing within their site, the ad networks know about your browsing right across the thousands, tens of thousands of websites that they might be associated with. As an experiment, you might like to use the Firefox web browser for a couple of weeks and use a plugin called Collusion. As you're browsing, it'll build a map like this. A bit hard to see, this is only after visiting half a dozen pages, but you should be able to make out Facebook's white F on a blue background, Google's G on a multicoloured background, and so on. The oldie-worldie T is, I believe, the Daily Telegraph, or not the Daily Telegraph, the UK newspaper, the Telegraph, and so on. So what Collusion will do is, as you browse through the websites, it will show you all of these connections and the ways in which data can be shared across those multiple sites. Now, that's the same case for every site that has a Facebook like button in it. That means there's program code in that page which tells Facebook that you visited that page and how long and so on. If you are currently logged into Facebook elsewhere on your computer, it will associate that browsing with your Facebook profile and everything it knows about you from that. Remember too that even though you may share information only with your friends on Facebook, that Facebook itself is everybody's friend and has access to everything about you, whatever your privacy settings may be. And as you can see, they can cross-match that with any number of other websites' browsing information and so on. So it's actually quite easy for organisations. I'm not picking on Facebook or Google in particular, because everyone is doing this. This is how the web is paid for. This is why all of the services are, quote, free, unquote. You are paying for them by giving them pretty much free run of your private data. You clicked on the OK button after reading the 3,000 words of terms and conditions. So you're all up to speed on that. You knew this already. No. Very few of us do. How many of you have heard of any of these companies? The usual answer is no one, so that's fine. These are some of the world's largest data brokers. Whenever you see in the privacy policy of an organisation that they are sharing your data with partners, these are the partners they have in mind. These companies buy and sell personal information. They do so by buying the questionnaire you might fill in when you entered a competition and it asked you about your interests. They also buy data from public sources, pre-compiled, all sorts of life events, births, deaths, marriages, divorces, arrests, charges, criminal proceedings, into jail, out of jail, legal cases, university graduations, anything that is publicly accessible. These companies will have some way of getting hold of that. And as I say, they trade in that. In many cases, they will do what's called renting a mailing list. You, again, wish to get a message in front of, I don't know, everyone who's aged between 18 and 25, female, from a non-English speaking background with a tertiary education, who is smoking but would like to give up smoking, and you know that because they clicked a couple of times on a quit ad during last year's quit campaign but never followed it up. They will say, excellent, that's 35,286 people in our database, and it'll cost you this much money for us to deliver a message to them. And these guys will, of course, have that capability back as a product they can sell to advertisers and so on. The other thing that they will do is, if they can cross-match that to your actual personal identity, then there might be someone like an insurance company who's very interested in hearing about that, because you actually ticked on your health insurance form that you were a non-smoker. So why are you clicking on internet ads for a quit program? Maybe your insurance will go up. Maybe they'll reject your application. Maybe they'll wait until you put in a claim and then sue you for document fraud. Now, all this has kind of been happening for years. These guys were around since the days of computers on punch cards. And there's nothing particularly new. We haven't heard of them because we don't do business with these people. These people do business with other big businesses and so on. The idea that your personal data is not shared, that they only share anonymous data, is a complete and utter furphy, because there have been massive advances in the last few years in what's called re-identification of anonymous data. Essentially, if I can give an easy example, say you have a whole bunch of data. It hasn't got any names and addresses and dates of birth in it, but it's got broad age groups, occupation, income levels, and so on. So if I were to pick postcode 2007 in Sydney and say that I had a 35-year-old female with a 7-year-old son, she's not married, she works as a nurse, was educated at UTS, and travels to Parramatta 5 times a week, how many people do you think there are matching that description? If that woman happens then to simultaneously, while browsing through a series of websites, hit the Sydney Morning Herald website, where she happens to be a member, then voila, they actually have her name, address, email address, date of birth, etc., because she registered there as a subscriber to the site so she could post comments. This re-identification is happening all the time. And to give you another couple of data points on that, you're all carrying a smartphone in your pocket, or if anyone in the room is not, you are, in this day and age, a most unusual person. Unless you have turned off all of the location tracking features of that phone, it is reporting your location to Apple in the case of an iPhone, Google in the case of an Android phone, to Microsoft in the case of a Windows phone, and to RIM in the case of a BlackBerry. And it only takes 6 timestamp geographic coordinates to uniquely identify an individual. We each have a unique pattern of movements. We each have a unique pattern of activities. So one of the big issues at the moment in privacy law, and this is a bit sideways from the topic, is this is only starting to be realised by the policymakers. It's relatively recent advancements in data re-identification. In the United States in particular, which has one of the more laissez-faire privacy regimes, they use the concept of personally identifiable information, which is, you know, name, date of birth, your address, your email address, something which will in and of itself uniquely fingerprint you. Everything else is fair game for the data brokers. In Australia, it's a slightly different regime, and it changes again in March 2014. So if you want to find out more about that, the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, oaic.gov.au, they have some fairly easy-to-read guides to it and all the links out from there. It's an interesting area, and there'll be a lot of stuff happening with that in the near future. Now, these guys used to be at the top of the food chain, in that they would gather up all of the data and would be able to compile it into dossiers. However, the social networking sites have now surpassed them in the range and quality of data that they have, simply because A, they know straight away who you are, and B, they have it in real time. They know what you're thinking about at that moment because you just typed it into a search box or you just told your best friend. So these companies are understandably worth a lot of money. Facebook is currently valued in the tens of billions of dollars, and they're growing larger. So they have these vast bodies of data. What we can do with them then becomes interesting. At one level, they've got the data about you, whether you're a smoker or not, and so on. At another level, they are probably starting to infer more about you. The classic example of this is Target in the United States. They're actually one of the market leaders in doing this sort of thing commercially. They can tell from a woman's shopping list with 85% chance of being correct when she becomes pregnant because her shopping list changes. Things like beauty products change to unscented versions. Certain vitamins and dietary supplements will appear or disappear from her shopping list. Obviously, as the pregnancy progresses and it gets nearer to the baby being born, well, there's certain supplies you need to have as a mother, certain clothing for the baby, cleaning products, etc., etc. It's all a well-ordered pattern. They can see it coming up. They also know, because they have noted which advertising offers this woman responds to, whether she is more likely to respond to certain kinds of advertising related to that baby. So that will make sure that the package of offers that are printed on her docket or sent out by email or however she said she wishes to be contacted, they'll make sure that they send offers that A, she will want because she's pregnant, and B, that she is likely to respond to based on their history of business interaction with this customer. They'll also make sure they don't give the game away by just suddenly sending her a lot of baby-related stuff. They'll make sure that they're also sending her the usual mix of power tools, breakfast cereal, clothing, grandmother stuff, just to not give the game away. This is state-of-the-art today, and there's a journalist who has written about this for the New York Times. If you want to dig that up, he's the full bottle on that. The target tell when you're pregnant is enough to search for and find that story. Another place to look for this is in the US site ProPublica. There's an article called "Everything We Know About What Data Brokers Know About You." Says what it says on the tin. A few other snippets there. What else can we tell from someone? There was a fad a few years ago for, and less so these days, but for little cute questionnaires. What sort of dog would you be if you were a dog? Most of them were thinly veiled psychological profiles on your decision-making behaviour. And at the end it said, oh, would you like us to email you the results? Just put your email address in here. So in that goes, that gets cross-matched with everything else. And some work at MIT in 2009 showed that if you follow the pattern of friend formation on Facebook, you can tell whether a young man is gay before he knows himself, just by monitoring the way that pattern of friend formation works. So we're talking about extremely powerful stuff, and from a commercial perspective or a political perspective, it doesn't have to be 100% right. 80, 90% right is good enough if it gives a commercial or political advantage. So there's kind of a quick view of the data and what's happening. And I'm going to turn to what happens on the news side. Who here uses Google News as a primary place of looking? For a few, handful. Do you use the customization things to say, Google, please have a look at my search history to make sure I see stories I'm interested in? Okay, it's worth playing with. And if you do so, find someone, I don't know, a relative maybe, a friend who's got really quite different tastes in some areas, and just follow how it shows you the news stories. At its most superficial level, if you happen to clearly have a search history that never includes sport, it will not tend to put sports stories up into your top stories, and so on. it also drill down further. So if it notes you're not just interested in business, but say the mining industry, then news about BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto and so on will tend to filter up higher. It takes a while to learn, but it learns remarkably quickly. That's kind of one level. So that's the beginning of the move away from the mass communication idea of everyone sees more or less the same thing to everyone starts seeing their own individually tailored version of reality. Next up is some of the stuff that's happening with what's called A-B testing. Now, the Huffington Post was one of the leaders in this. Essentially, what they do there is that every news story is written, as written by the journalist, is supplied with at least two different headlines. And for the first few minutes, the first maybe 1,000 or 2,000 people who are exposed to that headline, they're shown one of the headlines randomly. After a time, it becomes fairly clear automatically which headline is the one that attracts the most click-throughs, and that then becomes the headline for that story. That also works that way with Google AdWords. That's where you put text ads into Google as an advertiser, and your ads are placed against certain search terms. So, I don't know what it might be. I'm selling a secondhand BMW, for example, secondhand cars. I might try and probably a car dealer would do this rather than an individual, but it's structured so that anyone can create an account and do it. You can say, show my ad to people who are searching for BMW secondhand Sydney, only show it to people within the Sydney area, and I'm prepared to pay up to, I want to move this car, $5 per click-through for everyone who clicks on the ad. The mechanism is such that you don't pay a single cent if no one clicks through. Google will automatically handle any number of variants on that ad you choose to put in, and it will, again, start off by showing them randomly, and as soon as one version of the ad starts showing a clear preference for action, someone clicking through, it will start showing that ad in preference to all the others. There are ways, then, of connecting your website, if you have a full e-commerce website and perhaps not selling one car, but perhaps you're selling 50,000 BMW t-shirts, you can have it track all the way through to not just which ad you click on, but then which version of the web page about that t-shirt do you show the customer, which one is more likely to persuade that customer to buy the t-shirt, and the whole process can be automated start to finish. That's today. So we're starting to get some very interesting mechanisms which are already in place, and so far we're really only doing the basics. We're only reacting to kind of clicks. But that's where we are today. I should throw in that I didn't mention this morning, so bonus warning for you, places like the Huffington Post pay their journalists according to how many click-throughs the stories get. So it's a very unpleasant place. Now, I'm going to read you a news story. This is from 2009. Boston. Things looked bleak for the Angels when they trailed by two runs in the ninth innings, but Los Angeles recovered thanks to a key single from Vladimir Guerrero to pull out a 7-6 victory over the Boston Red Sox at Fenway Park on Sunday. Guerrero drove in two Angels runners. He went 2-4 at the plate. Don't know what the baseball stats mean, but what's interesting about that story, sounds like any routine regional sports story, is that it was written by computer. That was from 2009. The Intelligent Information Lab at Northwestern University, a project called StatsMonkey. And it basically took two things, a bunch of story templates which had different narrative arcs. Home team behind in the first half surges and makes good at the end, or league champions demolish opposition from the start, or whatever, whatever. That combined with a table of data of when the scores actually happened during the game. That was 09. Scroll ahead 2 years to 2011, here's another story. New home sales dipped year over year in May in the New York market, but the percentage decline, which was less severe than in April 2011, seemed to be signalling market improvement. There was a 7.7% decline in new home sales in 938, that's brackets houses sold in the period, from a year earlier. This came after a 21.6% drop year over year last month. In the 12 months ending May, blah, blah, blah. That also is a computer-generated story, but not as part of a university project. That is a live story in a live news outlet. That's 2011, 2 years ago. Now in 2013, vast slabs of routine real estate, stock market, and junior sports stories in the US are written by computer. The one I read at the end there is from a company called Narrative Science. They're one of the leaders in this. Another one is Automated Insights. And here's another story that is written. This one, I'm not sure who is the company behind it, but this is from the LA Times earlier this year. This is a routine earthquake story. They monitor the data feeds from the US Geological Survey, and if an earthquake is above a certain strength within a certain distance of Los Angeles, it fills out the template. How big was the earthquake? What were the suburbs nearby? Show us a map. And you can't see it, it's off the bottom of the screen, but are there any comments from the geologist on duty about what might be interesting about this earthquake? The story comes up, the sub-editor nods and presses publish. That's happening today. Not in Australia yet, as far as I know, but it's already happening in the States, and as I say, robots have been writing the news for 2 years. So if you're planning on becoming a journalist, this is what you're up against. The other thing, and I mentioned this at halfway through this presentation, if I had been a politician giving a press conference, a business leader making a keynote address or so on, we're about halfway through. So at about this stage, you should pretty much be halfway through writing your story, reporting on what I've said. It's fairly typical now, at least in the tech industry, for stories to be filed within 10 minutes of the presentation ending. Sometimes they're online beforehand because you realise the end of the story or the end of the presentation is a whole lot of stuff and there's nothing new. So bang, publish, you can always update it later. So I throw that in not as a, well, as a warning, I suppose, but also an interesting question mark about the future of news, given that the speed element is there, and the speed element, furthermore, feeds into the success of the story. Because if your story is the first one that is published online, it is likely to be the first one that gets tweeted and retweeted as a ripple and the one people read. And one of the factors Google News takes into account when deciding on story ranking is who was first. And it can often be obscure news outlets, but if they were the one at the car crash first and got the photo, then, you know, the Fatback Arkansas Times gets that lead story on the top of Google. Now, where am I going after this? Oh, yeah, that's... I should have chucked that out. That's how narrative science explains what they do. It explains nothing. But I just thought I'd throw that up, is that's how they're selling their services, that they magically receive data, create a story, and deliver insight. That's that kind of chart in the IT world is called a marketecture, because it looks at first glance like the architecture of some sort of system or process, but in fact really is just marketing buzzwords that means nothing. So what I want to do in the time left are two things. One is to show you how the sort of bubble effect of news is playing out, and then, as I said, look a little further into the future. Who here uses Twitter? I'm sure it's more than that, but some anyway, good. Either way, you'll probably be familiar with the concept of a hashtag, that is a keyword with a hash in front of it, that allows your tweets to turn up in certain searches and so on. Well, at the Queensland University of Technology, there's a Centre for Excellence in the Creative Industries and Innovation, but they've been doing a lot of mapping of the politics of Twitter in Australia. They have access to the raw feed of all tweets in real time. They filter out those which they know from Australia. Then they filter out the people who are talking about politics and the news, and then they start mapping them. Now, this is part of what they do. It's very difficult to see all the million users of Twitter in Australia in there. I think this is a subset of about 100,000 or something. Each dot represents a person. Each line represents a link between two people that they follow each other or converse with each other. And how a diagram like this works is you imagine each link is some sort of elastic connector. You put all the connections in and the elastic connections shrink, and clusters of people who are in more constant communication with each other become stretched and pulled closer together. So if I step through that, we find that in the middle of this cluster that everyone is connected to or talks about in some way is stuff to do about being on the internet or being on Twitter. It's the one thing everyone on Twitter has in common is the fact that they're on Twitter. So that and internet services and so on tends to be something in the middle of the conversational clusters. As you move out, you find that not everyone is interested in daily news, but we'll just put them down on the lower left for the sake of putting them somewhere. And as we'll see, that starts to develop subclusters around it. This is work done about 12 to 18 months ago, so there's probably a more up-to-date version on their website. There have been some subtle shifts. Those who particularly look at opinion stuff on the news tend to be closer to the middle, so more people talk about opinions on the news than about the news itself, which is interesting and perhaps obvious. The more conservative journalists don't read too much into the XY axes. They don't mean anything. It's just where we happen to be arranging them in space to give them space between them and other areas. But the conservative journalists sit there, the ALP and progressive politicians and related journalists there, and the Greens there. And the more hardline conservatives form a little island over there which has quite a lot of tight interconnection, people talking to each other, reading each other's material, commenting on it, and so on. We can step through this. This was, I said, about 18 months ago, so there wasn't a lot of difference that people who talked about news tend to talk equally about or communicate with or follow Kevin Rudd as opposed to Julia Gillard. Getting away from news, we find that there's a cluster of farmers talking about their life farming, for example, non-government organisations and social policy and so on. And I won't step through them all, but interestingly that there is a cluster of people in Perth who talk a lot amongst themselves about marketing and PR. They happen to be a particularly Twitter-enabled group of people. Business, property, jobs, parenting, mums, food, wine, beer, and then Adelaide out by itself, talking mostly about beer, wine, food, and itself. I'm from Adelaide, careful what you say. All sorts of others through. We find that different areas of music, of course, tend to have people talking about related areas of music. The little archipelago of Australian bands down there doesn't have a lot of connection with the rest of the world, like rest of Australia here. It kind of has some connections back into Triple J and music media more generally. It's generally believed that the followers of these bands will have more connections out internationally to followers of similar sorts of music, so they don't appear on this chart. Similar thing happens to sort of teen users of Twitter, which we're talking early teens there, and Twitter is not really a thing for early teens. The Jonas Brothers and the Beliebers are then their own separate island here, and some other special interest groups. Various sports, of course, have very tightly knit communities, as do teachers. Now, here's two interesting ones. Evangelical Christians are a separate group from the Hillsong brand of evangelical Christians, neither of whom have particularly strong links, at least on Twitter, to other sectors of the Australian community. So, again, the researchers assume that their strongest connection is with like-minded people internationally rather than within Australia. And that seems to make sense. They're fairly globally coherent subcultures rather than being necessarily specific to any one country. So then when you map onto that the use of hashtags, Queensland floods, well, floods really don't have anything to do with your religion or politics. You are going to be flooded or not, or you're going to have relatives in Queensland affected by the flood. So all of those dots reflecting people talking about the Queensland floods are scattered across the map. The election, AusVotes, again, this is not the current AusVotes election. This is kind of last time around. Again, it spread fairly heftily across the map, but obviously in areas which we identified as being the news media and opinion and politically motivated people are more active on those topics. The AusPoll hashtag is in fact not a broad Australian political discussion area at all, but heavily clustered towards the more hardline conservative end of the spectrum. And since this was done, I'm told by the researchers that AusPoll has now became so much of a bun fight with hardline conservatives arguing against their opponents that it's now really hard left, hard right, throwing insults at each other, and the whole middle of Australian political discourse avoids the AusPoll hashtag because they don't want to talk about politics in that way. So and WikiLeaks, another example, people talking about that spread broadly across politics but more towards the parts of the chart associated with the left, though not extremely so. You still have a lot of people on the centre-left, even centre-right, talking about it, about WikiLeaks there. So follow these guys. They have a fantastic blog. Bruns and Burgess will find it. And each week they have a thing called the Australian Twitter News Index where they list all of the most tweeted about and discussed news stories in Australia of the previous week on Twitter. And it's actually quite interesting because you see what people are talking about. But that then brings us back to another aspect of the filter bubble. If you were imagining that all of your political views came from AusPoll, I follow politics, I'll follow the AusPoll hashtag, you're getting a skewed view. But so would you be if you followed any of the points on the chart. You are seeing your own unique view of the world. Twitter's very much a choose your own adventure. So the question that has come up in the theory, I don't know if we've seen the theory about this yet in the course or...
They'll be talking about in Chutes today.
In Chutes today. You'll be getting some of the theory. This is how it's starting to unfold in practice. This is what we're noticing about it. So this is obviously very early research. We're starting to identify what some of these individual little filter bubbles might be and how people perceive the world. What that means yet, we don't know. Now, it's fun that we've got an election campaign on at the moment. We stay on Twitter. 2 weeks ago, this happened. Start at the bottom. We had someone called BT with a tweet about the Greens Party new election ad being very ordinary and telling the Greens they should get a new creative director. As we move up, a couple of people followed that, and even more people just repeated the same thing. Now, if you're not a regular user of Twitter, what you won't immediately notice is the fact that none of those in the top half are actually how a retweet looks. A retweet is formatted in a particular way. It's not just a copy and paste of the text. It's either flagged as a retweet automatically or by some sort of manual process by the person. And when you get up to the top, you look at this Benjamin Erb chap at the top, you start to notice his profile doesn't seem to quite fit. Benjamin Erb, but his handle is Johnny P from DC, and he's an attorney, but it says he's from Hawaii. And if you look at some of his other tweets, his tweets say he's from South Dakota. And then you notice, if you scroll through, that his tweets are a mix of fairly bland comments, the occasional quotes from a big book of quotes, and nothing else. And that's because Benjamin Erb is not a human being. He is a robot. He is one of the many fake Twitter followers that is just a piece of software that is existing on Twitter and is tweeting occasionally. Now, there's a lot of reasons for why Benjamin Erb might have joined that group of people bad-mouthing the Greens political ad. There was a lot of feeling on the day amongst the political media that, well, this is these fake Twitter followers and someone in Labor or Liberal has bought them and they're bad-mouthing the Greens. And, well, it could even be a member of the Greens is unhappy with the ad and is trying to get some change from within the organisation. It could be a disgruntled television director looking for work. It could be anyone. The thing that struck me, though, is that there were only 7 tweets, and I know that the bottom 2 at least are humans. At least the first one in the chain insists that he is human. So we've kind of let him get away with that for the time being. The reason why I thought this was not part of an organised campaign is that this is the going rate for fake Twitter followers as of this morning. $70 US will get you 10,000 fake Twitter followers. If this was part of a campaign and anyone was spending any more than pocket money, there would have been thousands of tweets like this. What the fake Twitter accounts do is once they've managed to get them logged in and started tweeting, the last thing they want is for these robots to be identified as spammers and blocked off Twitter. So they just randomly copy and paste tweets from around the world until they're called into use. And here's the going rates. As I say, this is from this morning. You can find cheaper from this in the, I was about to say the criminal underground. This is criminal, but hey, they take PayPal rather than Bitcoin, you know, so they're there. They're advertising, you know, or your favourite credit card. They don't consider it bulk until it's 250,000 fake Twitter followers. And I love the fact that they have a 100% retention guarantee. If some of your fake Twitter followers end up, for whatever reason, being killed off as spammers or whatever, they'll replace them free of charge. And that brings us to kind of speculating out to the future. How much time have I got? Lovely. Just a few minutes. Let's join all the dots here. Let's imagine that a political party knows about you. It knows where you are because you've got a phone in your pocket. It knows what style of advertising you're most likely to respond to. It knows what issues interest you because they both have a profile of you from one of the data mining companies, and also they can see the kinds of things you're talking about. That the kind of mindless chat robots on Twitter that just say, oh, you mentioned insurance, so I'll say, interested in home insurance, here's a link, that's kind of 20-year-old technology. The kind of basic customer service chat robot has been in use commercially for at least 5 years. The National Australia Bank here in Australia, for example, has since at least 08 from memory, been, you know, your basic chat on the website, hi, can you tell me how to apply for a home loan, etc. That's a robot you're talking to. It'll only summon in a human if it gets lost in what you're trying to say, or it gets to a point where there's a kind of legal compliance issue and they need to just make sure you understand something. All that's straightforward. Also, if you want to see in the level at which chat understanding is reaching today, I just draw your attention to A, it took 2 years for robot-written news stories to go from university research project to in production, and another 2 years for it to be commonplace. Look up the US Naval Research Laboratory, their cognitive robots project. It'll show you a lovely example of the state-of-the-art of robots understanding human speech. The video they've got, the first one there to play, which has 002 in the title, shows one researcher coming in to tell a robot, hi, today we are going to do more exercises in learning to recognise shapes. But first, I have some things to do. I'll just be down the corridor, I'll be back soon. Leaves. The other researcher comes in, says, hi, we were going to start some more shape recognition training today, but my colleague isn't here yet. The robot recognizes the fact that it has information that will assist the human at that point and says, yes, Susan said she had things to do. She will be back shortly. That's the level that they're at. That was a 2011 video. It's fun to watch the rest of it to just see the state of the art of where they're up to. And again, that's kind of, okay, university project now. The US Naval Research Lab is just another academic research environment like any other. So this is the kind of language recognition technology that is just around the corner. So I leave you perhaps with the thought that what if, as you're on the bus going past a local sports stadium, your phone rings and in the voice of your local candidate, it says, "Hi, I know you are really supportive of your local rugby team. You probably should know that the other party refused to fund the $20,000 upgrade of the facilities. Thanks and vote for us." All of the pieces are almost there. There is nothing to stop that really coming together apart from someone choosing to do so. Now, that's one level. Two other things to think about in all that, and I posit this as I have no answers. These are just the questions that will be coming up in a few years. What does it mean to have and exert power through the media or in the media when you have such detailed information about how someone will react psychologically to the precise message that you can tailor for them, and computing power is getting cheaper all the time? And the final thing is to remember that so far all of this is being handled not by public institutions and defenders of democracy, but by commercial organisations who have as their purpose of being to make money for their shareholders. Now, there's nothing evil about that. That's the point of business. That's what we have businesses for. But it does mean that all this comes under a commercial umbrella so far, and how does that interact with the rest of the world? We haven't had many, as far as we know, IT entrepreneurs wanting to make any massive political change. The closest we get is that there's kind of a Silicon Valley libertarianism about it all for small government and just please go away and let us make billions of dollars. But one that has come up is the late Steve Jobs, co-founder and head of Apple for a long time, who when asked why you could not get any more material rated R18 plus or above through the Apple iTunes store, he said that the iTunes store gives you freedom from pornography. Now, okay, whether you think that's a freedom or not is a question, but whether you think that's his right to decide whether you should have the right to see this or not is another question. He's denying a whole lot of material in the marketplace. So at the moment, with Apple controlling its store, Google controlling Androids, and Microsoft controlling the Windows Store and everything that gets loaded on your portable device and those devices coming down, we are starting to see the signs of at least, if not an overt pressure to change politics, at least a reduction in the ability to express political thoughts which a company might be uncomfortable with. And the classic example recently was an app that showed you on a map of Pakistan where all the latest US drone strikes were. And that has been banned by at least Apple and a couple of others because they just don't want politics discussed with that edginess in their store. It's all PG-13, thank you, and admire the flowers on your way out. Well, that's all I had to say today. I think, how we have time, a couple of questions?
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
And that's, I'll be putting that recording and links to all my stuff in the next couple of days on my website.
Great, so do we have any questions for Stu? We've probably got time for one or two, yes.
So, obviously, there's different implications from what all this data gathering means, and if you're talking about advertisers getting better efficiency from their advertising practices, you know, selling to pregnant women with any of those products, harmless implications.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you heard about Palantir? Have you got anything to say about that company?
Palantir, yeah, I haven't even touched upon how any of this stuff is used for national security or surveillance purposes. Palantir is a company that essentially provides data mining technology for law enforcement and intelligence agencies. It's one of the big players. So Imagine all of that, but instead of you're spotting when a woman becomes pregnant, you are spotting when someone becomes dissatisfied with their government to the point that they are expressing anger about it. That's a whole new subject for a whole nother time.
It's a really interesting idea that, you know, you can have all this data being tracked for people's commercial use and everything, but then it comes to, you know, warrantless mining of data, or I guess more scary applications when you've got, I guess, big data being used by really incredible programs.
Yeah, look, all I will say, there's a lovely line by... Oh, what was his name? The French diplomat in the court of one of the King Louis, I forget which one. And he said, "Give me six lines penned by the most honest man in the land, and in them I will find a way to hang him." it's a wonderful line. Things taken out of context, sure. You have a prescription for an antidepressant at one point, that's a mental illness. You have a prescription for an antidepressant 2 years later, you have a history of mental illness. That's why we had to shoot him.
Just quickly, maybe one more question. I know we're really sort of out of time. If you had a burning question that you wanted to ask Steele before he goes. No? Okay. I think you guys
are. Lovely.
Thanks, Steele.
Thanks very much. Thank you.